From the Moon Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the blockbuster video game Fortnite disappeared into a black hole over the weekend. We'll talk about the game's impact and what, if anything, comes next. Then director Roxanne Benjamin on the scary sounds of the new horror anthology series, Creepshow.
When you're on set and you're making genre, so much of it has to do with the soundscape and with building that sense of tension through music, through score, through silence, and when to break that silence.
And a 90s pop punk star reckons with a frightening diagnosis. All that coming up on The Frame. Over the weekend, about 11 o'clock on Sunday morning to be exact, the popular video game Fortnite went dark. Everything got sucked into a mysterious black hole. This is the sound from Fortnite's live stream. The publisher, Epic Games, dubbed the event The End. But is it really? Todd Spangler is covering the story for Variety. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So if I was playing Fortnite yesterday, what would have happened to me? Would the game have stopped midstream?
Well, just before, as you said, 11 o'clock Pacific time, the meteor in the game, which appeared at the beginning of Season 10, suddenly became active and set off a reaction that sucked everything into oblivion. No one was sure what had happened. The game came to a stop, and there was just that shimmering black hole. There was no explanation, and that was the end of the game, at least for now.
So my two kids, who are 19 and 15, don't play a lot of online games, but they used to play Fortnite, and then they didn't play it so much. So let's talk about the trajectory of the game itself. It has been wildly popular. Is it still as big a deal as it was maybe a year ago?
It's still going strong, yes. It's extremely popular, and Epic Games, the company that publishes it, says they have more than 250 million users who tune in at various times to play it.
The thing that certainly has struck me is this is a multi-generational game, that it appeals to young players as well as adults. What is it about Fortnite that kind of crosses those demographic lines? Why has it been so appealing to such a wide swath of the game-playing audience?
I think it is a really entertaining game to play. There are a lot of humorous elements in it. It's just really found traction because it's free to play. Anybody can just download it or start playing right away. So it's become this social online interactive activity for a lot of people. You know, I think what Epic Games is doing here is pretty smart in terms of generating buzz for this game, which is already hugely popular. I mean, here we are talking about it and wondering what they do next. But certainly a lot of people are upset and concerned and confused about what will happen when the game is going to come back.
And has there been any other game in the last couple of years that has had the same sort of cultural and economic impact as Fortnite?
There's nothing really that's crossed over in quite this way, where it's entered the mainstream culture and, you know, it became a popular, there have been a couple dances out of the game that have become memes unto themselves. And, you know, it's a big category on YouTube and other platforms for people sharing and talking about the game. And it's really built this huge fan culture. And, you know, the hope is, the expectation is that Epic Games won't overplay its hand here and return post-haste.
So to use a movie analogy, it almost feels like this is the latest Star Wars movie. It's doing really good business. And then Disney announces they're pulling the film from theaters in the middle of its run. Has there been any indication of what Epic Games is planning to do, why they made the game go away? What has been reported and what has been rumored?
Yeah, there's no official word yet on what's going to happen next, but there's the next campaign presumably coming up, and there haven't been any details about what Season 11 might be or what it will look like or when it will come back. So people are sitting on the edge of their seat trying to guess on what's going on here.
So if people really can't get through the day without playing Fortnite, which is a statement on its own, what are they doing now? Are they looking for other games? Are they just waiting, refreshing their screens? Is there any news about when it actually might return?
No, for now, people are sitting and waiting, or they've thrown up their hands and they said, okay, we're going to try a different game. And anecdotally, you see people expressing their frustration and saying they're gonna move on to a new game here. So, you know, we'll see how long Fortnite and Epic Games play this game with their fans and before they announce what might be coming next. But it would really boggle the mind if they just shut down the game and that was it.
I was talking to a couple of kids, not my own children, over the weekend, and they said, like, Fortnite isn't as good as it used to be. So for players who have given up Fortnite, might this be a way to kind of bring them back into the fold?
Absolutely. And that's, I think, part of the intent here, where they're literally rebooting the game. And, you know, there's the promise of a brand new experience, a brand new environment. And, they're trying to set some excitement here for what the next big version of the game looks like.
Todd Spangler is the New York digital editor at Variety. He joined us from the Variety newsroom. To get more industry news, go to variety.com. Todd, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Everybody wants to go to heaven. Nobody wants to die.
Now, we'd like to say farewell to George Chambers, the singer and bassist for the Chambers Brothers. He died this past weekend. After serving in the Korean War, George, who was the oldest brother, relocated his siblings from Carthage, Mississippi to Los Angeles. He, along with Lester, Willie, and Joe, formed the Chambers Brothers, a gospel quartet that incorporated psychedelic rock music. Early in the band's life, George was playing washtub bass, but as he, along with brothers Joe and Willie, told us back in 2017, one day he was forced to go electric.
We got to the Newport Folk Festival. Everybody's equipment got there except my washtub.
The tub didn't make the train. threw it off the train.
Came out of time to get on stage. I get up there with this band, Danny Electra, four strings, and I'm used to playing one string on the two. So in front of 33-something thousand people, that's how I started playing the electric bass.
George Chambers was 88 years old. Coming up, a horror director on the making of the new series, Creepshow. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The streaming service Shudder is kind of like a Netflix for fans of the horror genre. The AMC-owned service does original programming, too, and September saw the release of Creepshow.
There are things in the corners of this world.
Help me!
They'll drive you insane.
A new generation of horror has arisen. From the dead.
The anthology series is a reimagining of the 1982 Stephen King film of the same name. The 20-minute segments that make up the show are horror vignettes filled with practical effects and a fair amount of viscera. Director and horror effects master Greg Nicotero, who also worked on The Walking Dead, heads up the show. The directors include Roxanne Benjamin, and she told me about how meetings with the folks at Shudder led her to Nicotero's studio.
You know, I met with them, and they then had me meet with Greg out at K&B.
K&B is
his effects company.
Okay.
Yeah.
And, which is probably its own kind of scary tour.
Oh,
when you're
it
looking
is.
At all the creatures and gore that he's yeah. created through Walking
you're,
Dead and other shows.
You're walking into a haunted house, basically. And he was, you know, he's got all of this great stuff around that's just decades and decades worth. And his whole team, I mean, there's, you know, between all of them, like a century's worth of experience in doing this kind of stuff. And that was really, really appealing to me because usually on anything that's on an indie level, you want to do things practically, but you're usually so pressed for time that it ends up being something that you're going to work with in post or put in digitally. So to have something that the very basis of was to try to keep it in that old school kind of frame that the original Creepshow had and using all the practical effects is like, you know, very appealing to a filmmaker.
Did you grow up watching shows like Creepshow or what was your was your entertainment diet when you were young?
Well, I grew up basically in the woods in the Allegheny Mountains right next to National Forest Land in rural Pennsylvania. So there's not a lot to do out there. So it was I read a lot of books. I was reading like Stephen King and Dean Koontz and books like that and all of the EC comics when I was like 6, 7 years old because they were the only things that were in the house because it's also what my mother read.
Does that mean you're more inclined to certain kinds of stories? I mean, if you're painting this picture, I'm picturing your house and things that go bump in the night. It sounds like it could be the setting for any number of horror movies.
Oh, yeah.
Is that part of what your imagination was like when you were growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. And plus it's, you know, this is like pre-internet days and you're just kind of left with your own imagination. And this is also in a place where you were basically booted out the door at dawn and told to come back at sunset, you know, make sure you get back before the light disappears. And it sounds like I grew up in the 50s because like we would ride our bikes into town and, you know, buy EC comics and Tales from the Crypt at like the local dime drugstore.
We're talking with director Roxanne Benjamin. I want to play a cut from one of your segments for Creepshow. This one is called Lydia Lane's Better Half. You can figure out what the better half might be after you watch that episode. And it's a scene where the actor Daniel Lynn loses a promotion her female boss and maybe closer friend than that had promised her.
All of this bullshit about being a paragon of women's empowerment, littering the floors with the shards of glass ceilings that you've shattered. Well curated bull, my dear, but bull all the same.
This is such a bigger story about the way women mentor other women and the promises they make. And it is essentially, it's a betrayal that her boss has promised her something that she doesn't get. And it's about what happens after that. And it feels like that could be in any office, in any part of the world, any day, any night.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. I read all of the kind of available episodes kind of in the beginning, and Greg was very much like, which ones do you gravitate towards? And that one from the beginning was something that I was very interested in. It's a much more emotionally dense and nuanced genre piece, I think, than your typical like morality tale that you get out of these short form horror pieces. So that was really appealing. And the fact that it was dealing with the relationships between two women who might have a personal relationship as well as what that looks like in this business world where it's, you know, just dog eat dog and women in positions of power are looked upon in a certain way. And it's something that, you know, as a director, you have to put yourself in the shoes of both of those characters and see them as the person in the right so that you can work with the actor on that side. So you can really look at it from both sides of the fence and be on one character's side throughout until you're not.
These are vignettes, and you also produced the VHS movies and you worked on Southbound, another anthology series. What do those kinds of stories give you that maybe a feature-length movie doesn't? What's the advantage of this kind of compartmentalized short pieces?
The thing that I think works about these types of stories is that they're morality tales at the end of the day. At their simplest form, it's folktale. You're working in folklore and mythology in a way, and that's kind of the very basis of why we tell stories, I feel, is to impart some sort of lesson in life or something that you're supposed to take from it that is either to help you or warn you about the circumstances of life. And this provides a format to do that in its absolute purest and simplest form. And like I said, even that it's genre, that it's this heightened sense of all of that in its absolute purest form. And you're also kind of working with, you have a first act and a third act and no second act. So there's no possibility that anything's going to drag because you're just going from problem to solution or, you know, lack thereof and consequences thereof in these kind of stories.
But I think what you touched on is really important because I think part of the reason why certain filmmakers, and I can't help but think of Jordan Peele, are doing so well with genre films is because the movies aren't about the scares. They're about what's prompting the people to behave the way that they're behaving. And that's where horror can get at real human behavior in ways that ordinary dramas can't because they can amplify everything. And I wonder if you think that's part of why horror is having a resurgence. There are obviously a lot of bad horror movies, but are they able to address fears and worries that we have in ways that other stories can't?
I think absolutely. And it kind of touches on the idea that I think a lot of people in the general film-going community or, you know, film aficionados look down on horror because what they think of horror is actually terror, which is jump scare moments or that moment of, oh my God, that gives you, you know, the fast heart rate and has you kind of jumping in your seat. But what we have really in genre is horror a lot of the time, you know, where you're dealing with something that's a horrific situation that is much more drawn out and long and gives a sense of like true darkness and evil to it. So there's much more to play with there in terms of how that affects us in a real way with character versus just terror. And I really wish that that was kind of pushed more to the forefront because it's kind of what I think people call elevated genre now, which is the idea that it does have something more going on for it than we're on a roller coaster and here's some boo scares.
There's a moment in your Creepshow episode where there's a glass object that gets wedged into, let's just say it gets wedged into a part of somebody's body, and that's grisly enough, but the sound effects that are added in post about what that object sounds like when it's pulled out are beyond describing. Just, I don't even know how they come up with it, but when you hear and go through your sound mix and hear what sound design can add to the things that you've shot, how does it make you feel? Are you intrigued, nauseated? What's your reaction?
The sound process is my favorite part. It's my favorite part. Although, you know, whenever I'm directing, I'm always, whatever the thing is we're doing in that moment, I'm always like, this is my favorite part. But if I really looked at it, I would have to say sound, working in sound is my favorite part because that's where it really starts to feel like it's coming together. Because when you're on set and you're making genre, so much of it has to do with the soundscape and with building that sense of tension through music, through score, through silence and when to break that silence. So much of it has to do with sound. It's 50-50 on the visual and the sound. It's so important in genre, where I think that skews much more to the visual in straight film, I guess you would say. So when you're on set, half the time you're like, this is so dumb. This is going to be so stupid. I'm a failure at life. And then you get it into the mix and you get it into Foley and it starts to come together and you're like, yes, this is what I had in my head while we were there. And you just have to get past that piece to get to the real meat of it, which comes with the sound design.
Roxanne Benjamin, thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Roxanne Benjamin's first segment for Creepshow drops Thursday on Shudder. Coming up, Art Alexakis, a mainstay of 90s rock radio with his band Everclear, strikes out on his own. one of the punk pop stars of the 1990s, is back with a solo album. Art Alex Akis, the front man of Everclear, has a lot of heavy things on his mind: white supremacists, cyberbullies, and living with a scary disease. But as he explained to the Frame contributor Tim Grieving, this might be his sunniest album yet.
Art Alex Akis shouldn't be alive. He grew up in Mar Vista Project housing, raised on welfare by a single mom after being abandoned by his father. He was addicted to drugs by his teens, lost his girlfriend and his older brother to drug overdoses, and tried to drown himself off the Santa Monica Pier. But he survived, got sober, and in 1992, he founded Everclear.
You get beat up, you get up again. And that's the hardest part, is getting back up again. Doesn't mean you're going to win next time, but you're still there, you're still in the game. And that, to me, is everything.
Their hit records were Father of Mine, I Will Buy You a New Life, and Wonderful. Tell me everything is wonderful now. Alex Akis' lyrics have always been incredibly personal. Just listen to this song that he wrote for his oldest daughter. Gonna find a reason to hate me someday. Gonna find a reason to push me away. You are gonna find reasons to blame me for your pain. His songs fused punk rock attitude with pop catchiness, and even, at times, lush orchestration and Beach Boys style harmonies.
The intro for So Much for the Afterglow, which is like the Beach Boys-like intro, I went and recorded probably half of those and doubled them. And then I brought those guys in to double and triple with their voices on everything else.
He basically took that approach to the extreme on his new solo album, recording every single part himself at his modest studio in Pasadena.
This is the studio. This is where I recorded that record. If you came at any given time when I was doing vocals, I had this all walled off and a mic set up, and that was my vocal booth.
When I met Alex Akis at his studio the other day, his pipe sounded much more frail, mostly because he was getting over a flu. But years of rock and roll have taken their toll on other parts of his 57-year-old body.
I have a bad knee and a bad hip. I got to get my hip replaced. And I couldn't play a kick drum like I normally can. I've been playing drums for years. So I did all the drums like old school, like you're in like junior high music shop, right? And I'm just hitting kicks and hitting snares like this. Boom, ta, boom, ta, boom, boom.
Notably less sturdy on his feet these days, people started gossiping that he was back on the bottle last year. That's when he decided to make something public. A few years ago, Alex Akis was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis.
When I first got diagnosed, I read about the hot water test that they used to use to diagnose people. And I was like, man, people with these kind of diseases, it's like a constant hot water test. You're constantly being poked and prodded verbally and sometimes in real life and sometimes just by yourself and by your own self-doubts. Like, chances are 50-50 that you're going to end up in a wheelchair. It's pretty scary. That was scary. My doctors told me that I had a disease. I will slowly fall apart until there's nothing left that looks like me. Like I said in the song, me and my wife called her and told her, and we both started crying. You know, and by the time I got home, she was like, she looked like she was hacking into Fort Knox or something. She had like three computers up on the bed. She's like, baby, we got this. We got this.
Besides openly addressing his disease on the album, Alex Akis vents about the horrors of cyberbullies and Trump. One song is called White People Scare Me, but despite all the darkness, it's a surprisingly major key album, which is, after all, called Sun Songs.
And I wrote a song on the record that I'd never done before. It was like I wrote a love song for my wife, Sunshine Love Song. I wrote a love song for my daughter, Arizona Star. And I wrote a love song for me. I gotta tell you one thing about this disease, having this disease, it's really made me extremely grateful for just about everything. And I'm just so much easier to deal with. We're all gonna die, and until we die, let's figure it out. I know that sounds super hippie, and that goes against my grain as being an avowed punk rocker my whole life, but I guess I am just becoming much more just take it as it comes.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
He plays guitar in his car at night when he needs a place to be alone.
Sun Songs, the new record from Art Alexakis, is available in record stores and on streaming sites. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn at the Mode Broadcast Center. Remember, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. You'll find us at The Frame. On Tuesday, KPCC will be airing the debate among presidential contenders from the Democratic Party. So we'll see you back here on Wednesday.